Welcome to the Earth First Update, bringing you all the environmental news you can use for over 20 years. I'm Uncle Dennis, here in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.3 FM and www.freakradio.org on Thursday, the 15th of June, 2017. I want to ask you to please have your pencil and paper handy so you can take down the names, addresses, email, web pages, and phone numbers so you can take action for the environment. Let's start with announcements. Announcing the 2017 Earth First Round River Rendezvous in California. Greetings. We are very excited to announce the 2017 Earth First Round River Rendezvous in so-called Northern California. From July 2nd to 9th, we will converge to share skills, strategize, and scheme to defend the world and the wild. Come prepared to camp out and be as self-sustainable as possible. The airport closest to the site is the Arcata Eureka Airport, and Eureka is the nearest big town. All across the continent, Earth Firsters and eco-defenders are resisting everything from the logging of old-growth forests, the construction of toxic prisons, and the maintenance of existing ones, to an onslaught of pipelines that leave scars across the landscape and threaten our waterways. The extraction industry is enabled and emboldened by the current administration's attempt to push through many previously defeated projects. It is now more important than ever that we stand together for the wild and defend against the capitalist death machine. We're excited to see you all out here soon, and we'll have more information about that as we get to more information from the Earth First Newswire. Here in Santa Cruz, a estuary revegetation restoration project will be happening this Saturday, June 17th at 9 a.m., at the intersection east of Riverside Avenue and San Lorenzo Boulevard at the Riverside Avenue Bridge above the Mike Fox Park. The project will remove invasive plants, do weeding and chipping at the east intersection of Riverside Drive and San Lorenzo Boulevard. If you'd like to take part, please go to Meetup for the Ventana Chapter and the Santa Cruz Group Sierra Club. And Cascadia Wildlands is hiring a grassroots organizer that reports to the executive director. The hours are flexible and the job is a half to three-quarters time. The grassroots organizer works to advance Cascadia Wildlands conservation campaigns and mission and vision through community outreach, education, and mobilization. The successful candidate will utilize grassroots organizing strategies and tactics to educate, engage, and activate our constituency, including through presentations and tabling opportunities, public hikes, rallies, and demonstrations, social media event planning, volunteer management, alliance building, and other movement building techniques. Reporting to the executive director, the grassroots organizer works in a team setting with other staff on conservation campaigns and is expected to take leadership role in developing and implementing all phases of Cascadia Wildlands grassroots outreach. The position has potential to become full-time in the future. If you're interested, go to www.cascwild.org. That's www.cascwild.org for a full list of requirements. And an anti-logging camp has been forcibly evicted and protesters attacked in Mexico. On the morning of Wednesday, June 7th, the Civil Society of Tepoztlan, as Governor Gracio Ramirez's administration calls it, headed by Gabino Rios and his hitmen, evicted the camp from the United Fronts in defense of Tepoztlan and environmentalists held in front of the gazebo at the entrance to the town. This morning, citizens of Tepoztlan decided to intervene to liberate an entrance to the municipality, said the Gracio Ramirez government in a bulletin, identifying as part of civil society Gabino Rios, former mayor and now owner of a construction business, linked to the extension of the La Pera-Cualtoa highway, who, with a group of hitmen and trucks, appeared at the roundabout at 7 a.m. to evict the camp set up weeks ago when the ecocide occurred, in which 3,000 trees were felled. In Tepoztlan, the tension could be felt in the air since dawn due to the possible repression and eviction. The ringing of church bells intensified. People left their homes. In a short period of time, a shock group led by former mayor Gabino Rios appeared to intimidate and evict the camp. People left their homes to march from the camp located in the entrance to town towards the mayor's office. Upon arrival, police and the shock group denied them entry. The demonstrators, members of United Fronts of Defense of Poztlan, tried to set up a camp next to the gazebo in hopes of having a dialogue with the authorities responsible for the ecocide, but were followed by a group of hitmen who, with blows and threats, also forced them to leave the area. In a press conference, the United Fronts in Defense of Poztlan refuted the Morelos state government statement issued the same day, claiming the highway is a decision of the citizens of Poztlan. That is a lie. We cannot think it is the decision of citizens to support a company evicting us in a violent and provocative way. If the state government considers the former official and now construction business owner Gabino Rios and his hitmen to be civil society, it's a shame. They are hitmen and are paid to do it. In front of them are different groups. We are women, children, activists, human rights defenders, students, environmentalists who self-identify as a group opposed to development. There was no reason to evict us because we were not blocking traffic. For a week, the way had been clear. Consequently, they evicted a peaceful camp of protest, not a blockade, argued the members of the United Fronts in Defense of Poztlan. And Secretary Zinke undermines the greater sage-grouse conservation plans in this story from the Center for Biological Diversity, written by Randy Spivak. Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke announced plans for a review that threatens to undermine the efforts to protect the iconic greater sage-grouse across 11 western states. Zinke's plan could give big oil companies and other polluters new access to vital grouse habitat. Zinke's review is clearly a pretext to push the sage-grouse to extinction and return for short-term profits for his corporate buddies. They might as well form a shotgun posse to kill off the species directly, said Randy Spivak, Public Lands Program Director with the Center for Biological Diversity. We'll do everything in our power to make sure this amazing bird and its habitat is protected. The greater sage-grouse, an iconic bird known and loved for its elaborate mating dance, is imperiled. As many as 16 million birds once ranged across 297 million acres of sagebrush grasslands in an area of western North America known as the Sagebrush Sea. Over the past 200 years, agricultural, oil and gas drilling, livestock grazing and development have reduced sage-grouse range by nearly half, and sage-grouse populations have steadily declined. Today, sage-grouse are found only in 11 western states: California, Colorado, Idaho, Montana, Nevada, North Dakota, Oregon, South Dakota, Utah, Washington, and Wyoming. Protecting the greater sage-grouse benefits a host of other species that depend on the sagebrush sea, including pronghorn antelope, elk, mule deer, golden eagles, native trout, and nearly 200 migratory and resident bird species. The Bureau of Land Management is responsible for managing about half of the remaining sage-grouse habitat. After years of inaction and prompted by a 2011 decision by the Fish and Wildlife Service to list the bird for protection under the Endangered Species Act, the Bureau of Land Management initiated sage-grouse protection planning. This unprecedented five-year effort led by the Department of Interior resulted in land use plans with new measures to conserve sage-grouse and potentially prevent the need to list the species as endangered. The Fish and Wildlife Service's decision not to list the sage-grouse was predicated on the assumption that public land management plans would be implemented and would reverse the decline of the greater sage-grouse. For more information, go to www.biologicaldiversity.org. And a judge has ordered the Dakota Access Pipeline review, citing environmental justice. The judge didn't shut down the oil flow, but didn't rule that out either. Expediting the pipeline's construction had been one of Trump's first orders as president, in this story written by Marianne Lavelle of Inside Climate News. In a setback for the Trump administration's drive to ramp up fossil fuel development and a tentative victory for the Standing Rock Sioux tribe, a federal judge has ordered an expanded environmental review of the Dakota Access Pipeline. U.S. District Judge James Boasberg wrote that the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers did not adequately consider the impacts of an oil spill on fishing rights, hunting rights, or environmental justice, or the degree to which the pipeline's effects are likely to be highly controversial. The Corps' decision allowing the pipeline to cross under the Missouri River half a mile upstream from the Standing Rock Reservation was made on February 3rd, just 2 weeks after President Donald Trump took office, and was devoid of any discussion of the evidence of risk that the tribe had submitted, the judge wrote. The court cannot conclude that the Corps made a convincing case of no significant impact or took the requisite hard look, he said. Boasberg did not immediately rule on whether the flow of oil, which started through the pipeline on June 1st, should be stopped. He wrote that a decision on that will be the subject of a further briefing later this week. The pipeline's construction spurred months of protests and dozens of arrests over its location near the Standing Rock Reservation, and particularly its crossing under the Missouri River at Lake Oahe, the tribe's water supply, and an area it considers sacred. The tribe filed suit in July of 2016 after the Corps concluded that a cursory environmental assessment of the pipeline project was sufficient and released a finding of no significant impact. At the time, the Obama Interior Department and Environmental Protection Agency both raised concerns about the lack of a full environmental impact statement, a more rigorous level of review. The EPA said the Corps' assessment did not sufficiently consider the impacts on water resources, and the Corps later agreed to that more in-depth review. As we all know, Boasberg wrote, elections have consequences, and the government's position on the easement shifted significantly once President Trump assumed office. In one of his first acts as president, Donald Trump issued a presidential memorandum directing the Corps to expedite the pipeline's approval. Boasberg's decision on Wednesday was not an outright victory for Standing Rock. The judge found that the Corps' decision not to issue a detailed environmental impact largely complied with the law, but the exceptions were substantial, he said, including the Corps' failure to offer any acknowledgement of or attention to the impact of an oil spill on the tribe's fishing and hunting rights. The Corps had dismissed the tribe's concerns summarily, pointing to the project's state-of-the-art construction techniques and use of high-quality materials and standards. There will be no direct or indirect effects to the Standing Rock Sioux tribe, the Corps said in its environmental assessment. But Boasberg said the Corps was looking only at the project's construction, not the potential for a spill. Furthermore, the treatment fell short of the Corps' duty to determine whether the project would have a disproportionate impact on minority and low-income populations, as the agency is required to do by law. Boasberg cited Council of Environmental Quality guidance on environmental justice and case law under the National Environmental Policy Act. The Corps, in its decision, is silent, for instance, on the distinct cultural practices of the tribe and the social and economic factors that might amplify its experience of the environmental effects of an oil spill, Boasberg said. Standing Rock provides one such example in its briefing. Many of its members fish, hunt, and gather for subsistence. Losing the ability to do so could seriously and disproportionately harm those individuals relative to those in nearby non-tribal communities. The Corps need not necessarily have addressed that particular issue, but it needed to offer more than a bare-bones conclusion that Standing Rock would not be disproportionately harmed by a spill, the judge said. And the federal recovery plan for the California salamander seeks to protect 400,000 acres. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service today released a final recovery plan for the threatened Central California population of the California tiger salamander, calling for protection of 400,000 acres of breeding ponds and adjacent uplands. The recovery plan, which comes more than a decade after the amphibian received Endangered Species Act protection, is in accordance with a legal settlement between the agency and the Center for Biological Diversity. With a recovery plan, we can fight threats like habitat destruction that have pushed these extraordinary salamanders to the brink of extinction, said Jenny Loda, a biologist and attorney with the center working to protect rare amphibians and reptiles. This plan gives us hope for one of our most imperiled salamanders. The recovery plan focuses primarily on alleviating the threat of habitat loss and fragmentation by permanently protecting breeding ponds and adjacent uplands throughout the salamander's range. The amphibian lives in 23 counties along the foothills of California's Central Valley and Inner Coast Range. The plan also calls for site-specific management and monitoring plans for the protected lands. These will both ensure continued management suitability and the deal with other threats to the species, such as contaminants, non-native predators, disease, and climate change. Protecting the wild places unique to tiger salamanders' need to survive won't be easy, but we can't afford to lose these beautiful amphibians forever, Lotus said. I hope federal, state, and local agencies, as well as developers and farmers, will all step up to support the important work of recovery. Although Central California tiger salamanders have been protected under the Endangered Species Act for more than a decade, the Fish and Wildlife Service had not developed the required recovery plan to guide their management. In April of 2012, the Center for Biological Diversity sued the agency for its failure to develop such a plan. The plan released is the result of the settlement agreement, which resulted from the lawsuit. Recovery plans are the main tool for identifying actions necessary to save endangered species from extinction and eventually remove their protection under the Endangered Species Act. Research by the Center for Biological Diversity has found that species with dedicated recovery plans are for 2 or more years are far more likely to be improving than those without. The California tiger salamander is a large, stocky terrestrial salamander with a broad, rounded snout and gorgeous black and yellow body. These amphibians are restricted to vernal pools and seasonal ponds in grassland and oak savanna communities, where they spend most of their lives in underground burrows. The primary cause of their decline is the loss, degradation, and fragmentation of habitat through human activities and the encroachment of invasive species. The Central California population of the California tiger salamander was listed as threatened species in 2004. This species' historical range encompasses the San Joaquin-Sacramento River valleys, bordering foothills and coastal valleys of Central California. Some populations are now isolated because highways create impassable barriers for their migration. For more information about the Center for Biological Diversity, go to www.biologicaldiversity.org. And an immediate ban has been sought for the M44 cyanide bombs in Wyoming. A coalition of conservation and wildlife organizations has petitioned the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Wildlife Service's annual animal killing program for an immediate ban on the use of M44 cyanide devices in Wyoming. Also known as cyanide bombs, M44 has recently killed 2 family dogs in Wyoming and hospitalized an Idaho teenager after killing his pet dog. A similar petition was filed in Idaho in March, after which Wildlife Services agreed to remove M44s from all the lands in Idaho. We're not at war with native wildlife, and it is irresponsible to allow poison landmines to be sown anywhere in Wyoming, said Eric Mulvar, executive director of the Western Watersheds Project. Wildlife Services got rid of M44s in Idaho, and they should do the same in Wyoming before more pets and even people get hurt or killed. The organizations requested the immediate removal of all existing devices from Wyoming. M44s, also called coyote getters, lead to the agonizing death of thousands of animals every year, many of them non-target animals. Between 2000 and 2016, M44s in Wyoming killed 5,973 target animals, 112 non-target animals, including 8 dogs, and 447 unclassified animals, according to the Agriculture Department's Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service, which oversees the Wildlife Services program. In addition, at least 2 dogs have been killed in 2017. There is absolutely no reason for the government agency to be placing poisonous gas anywhere, much less mere yards from where people and pets live, said Tara Zuardo, wildlife attorney with the Animal Welfare Institute. Devices like these are not only extremely dangerous, but they also represent wasteful spending of taxpayer dollars and are the cause of tremendous suffering for both people and animals. The incredibly dangerous devices kill indiscriminately, and the deaths of pets are common, said Brooks Fahey, director of Predator Defense. Unless there are witnesses, agencies often don't record the poisonings. Families are then left to wonder what happened to their dog. These incidents display the extremely dangerous and indiscriminate nature of M44 cyanide bombs and Wildlife Services negligence, said Michelle Lute, Wildlife Coexistence Campaigner for Wild Earth Guardians. Federal employees should not be placing deadly devices anywhere on our public or private lands, which should be safe for families to recreate with their companion animals. And the Trump administration pushes coal mining in roadless forests in Colorado. The mine would be next to the West Elk Wilderness, giving Arch Coal access to more than 17 million tons of coal. Just days after announcing the U.S. will exit the Paris Climate Agreement, the Trump administration has pushed ahead with plans for another damaging action, a plan to approve Arch Coal's proposal to lease 1,700 acres of roadless wildlands in the Gunnison National Forest for mining 17 million tons of coal. The plan, addressed in a draft environmental impact study, would greenlight exploratory drilling and road construction to expand the West Elk coal mine about 40 miles southwest of Aspen. Local, regional, and national conservation groups condemned the proposal. This coal mine expansion brings Trump's dirty energy agenda to Colorado, said Matt Reed, public lands director for Gunnison County-based High Country Conservation Advocates. Pristine forests, abundant wildlife, clean water, and a healthy snowpack are the cornerstones of our local economy and quality of life, and this destructive proposal threatens all of these values. The Colorado mine expansion follows high-profile Trump actions to allow coal mines and coal-fired power plants to foul America's air and water, including killing rules meant to stop mines from dumping millions of tons of metal-laced waste rock into streams, rolling back measures limiting arsenic, lead, and mercury pollution poured into rivers and lakes by coal-fired power plants, gutting protections that limit health-threatening air pollution such as from such plants, and terminating America's commitment to reduce planet heating climate pollution pursuant to the Paris Agreement signed by more than 190 other nations. Under Arch Coal's plan, more than 6 miles of road will be bulldozed and as many as 48 drilling pads with vents to release methane will be built on the Sunset Roadless area, which is adjacent to the West Elk Wilderness. The area is a rolling landscape of aspen and spruce fir forests that provide habitat for black elk, black bear, elk, lynx, and cutthroat trout. Mining in this pristine area will create a spiderweb of roads and industrial facilities on 1,700 acres of public lands, similar to that already encroaching toward the wilderness. Bulldozing aspen groves to mine coal is exactly the senseless destruction we've come to expect from the Trump administration, said Allison Melton, an attorney with the Center for Biological Diversity. But it's madness for the climate and a raw deal for the people of Colorado, and we're not going to sit still and let it happen. The Trump administration's latest action exploits Colorado's roadless rule loophole, reinstated last year after being thrown out by a lawsuit which opened the door for road construction within about 20,000 acres of the Gunnison National Forest to subsidize coal mining. The lease that the Forest Service is poised to approve will give Arch Coal access to more than 17 million tons of coal, extending the life of the West Elk mine by about 3 or 4 years. The company already has an estimated 10-year supply of coal under lease. And experts say that captive breeding of sage grouse won't work. In this story by Angus Thurmer Jr. and Andrew Graham of Wyophile, prominent greater sage-grouse conservationists say Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke's plan to consider captive breeding of the bird would meet a dead end. In announcing a review of federal west-wide conservation plans for the imperiled bird, Zinke last week said innovative ideas, certainly to include captive breeding programs, would be considered by a task force. But several persons immersed in sage-grouse conservation say captive breeding hasn't worked, is inappropriate, and may harm wild sage-grouse populations. Among those is Wyoming Governor Matt Mead, who helped lead nationwide conservation by continuing the state's core area preservation strategy to limit habitat disturbance, not raise game farm birds. I follow the lead of our scientists and experts on that, who suggested that it's really not going to be something that works, Mead told Wyophile last week. The federal grouse conservation effort concluded in 2015 with a revision of 98 Bureau of Land Management and Forest Service plans in 10 states, focused on habitat, not grouse numbers. Adoption of the plans covering 67 million federal acres kept the grouse from being listed as threatened or endangered. The issue wasn't necessarily a population at a point in time. It's whether the habitat was there to support a healthy population, Mead said of the federal strategy Wyoming participated in. If we're talking about captive breeding, it sort of dismisses that there's a healthy population of birds out there. There's many, many birds. Zinke's secretarial order calls for integration of state and local concerns and approaches into sagebrush management and conservation on federal lands. It asks a task force to give appropriate weight to the value of energy and other development of public lands. A goal is to conserve the sage grouse and its habitat without inhibiting job creation or local economic growth. Zinke's order refers frequently to habitat and calls for an examination of invasive grasses that could spread fire through sagebrush, along with a review of firefighting strategy. A listing under the Endangered Species Act would put great restraints, likely greater than those imposed by the 2015 conservation plans, on what could happen in federal and private sagebrush country. And unfortunately, that's all the time we have for the Earth First Update this week. The Earth First Update is presented every Thursday evening at 9 o'clock here on Free Radio Santa Cruz 101.3 and www.freakradio.org. You can hear a rebroadcast of this show tomorrow, Friday, at 3 p.m. You could also listen to WMNB 107.1 in North Adams, Massachusetts, Friday at 5:30 p.m., KRFP 90.3 in Moscow, Idaho, Wednesdays at 3 p.m., KOWA 106.5 in Olympia, Washington, Saturdays at 7 a.m., and WLSL 92.7 in Dade City, Florida, Sundays at noon. KHCF 89.9 in Morgan Hill, Gilroy, California, KGIG 104.9 in Modesto, California, and KPHD 93.3 in Modesto, California, and Berkeley Liberation Radio at 104.1 FM in Berkeley also rebroadcast the Earth First Update. Check their website for times and dates. Or you could always go to radioforall.net, where you can listen online or download this or previous Earth First Updates. And please ask your local nonprofit community radio station to air the Earth First Update every week. It is free to download and rebroadcast. I will not be producing a show next week, so I hope to produce another show in 2 weeks. The Earth First Update is a production of Earth First Radio and is produced at Free Radio Santa Cruz. I'd like to thank you for listening. I'm Uncle Dennis, and please do tune in next week for another Earth First Update.